the media company now we're talking about. Truth Social is failing, almost no revenue, negative profitability. What is it? Was it a grift all along? Was it a scam all along? Was it a way to attempt to funnel Trump money for legal fees? I don't know the answer, but the stock value should be collapsing. And people who got tricked into investing in it, at some point, we can't save everyone, right? It can't be, conservatives say, the government can't go around saving anybody. You have the right to make bad financial decisions. Well, the people who invested in the DJT stock have indeed made bad financial decisions. I guess by conservatives' own principles, they're now going to have to deal with it. Sad. Very, very sad. We've got a great bonus show for you today. We are going to talk about public opinion on the Trump hush money case. Most Americans think it is a very serious set of charges. We will talk about the Tennessee Senate passing a bill that allows teachers to carry guns in classrooms. What? Yes, they are doing it. And we will talk about former Speaker Kevin McCarthy's latest claims that the real reason he was kicked out as Speaker is because Matt Gaetz had sex with a 17-year-old and McCarthy wasn't willing to help him cover it up. All of those stories and more on today's bonus show.
Oh, the bonus show where you want to make money, but everybody else that makes money to fund themselves is bad.
Sign up at joinpacman.com. Remember that when the new website goes live Sunday, membership prices go up, but you can lock in today's rates forever by signing up at joinpacman.com. And remember, you can get my latest children's book, Think Like a Voter, a great book for an election year. Just a single day after Donald Trump bragged about ending Roe v. Wade and endorsing whatever states want to do as long as you vote for him, the Arizona Supreme Court has upheld a near total abortion ban that was passed in 64. That's 1864, not 1964, an 1864 anti-abortion bill that comes with the potential for imprisonment for doctors who perform or participate in abortions. Providers can be subject to 2 to 5 years in prison. Wow. And all of a sudden, the implications of what Trump is saying are very, very real. NPR reports the Arizona Supreme Court allows a near total abortion ban to take effect soon. There's the medical and ethical reality, and then there's the political repercussions, which seem to be sort of bad regardless of your view on abortion. And I'll get to that in a moment. The NPR article explains abortions will soon be outlawed in Arizona, except in cases where a pregnant person's life is at risk. Note that missing from that are exceptions for rape and incest. The only exception is life of the mother. The state Supreme Court has ruled that Arizona should follow a restrictive abortion law dating back to the 1860s. Since December of 2022, Arizona doctors have been allowed to provide abortions up to 15 weeks into a pregnancy based on a lower court's interpretation of state law. But the state Supreme Court now says Arizona should follow a law banning abortions in almost all cases. It makes no exceptions for rape, no exceptions for incest, and makes performing an abortion punishable by 2 to 5 years in prison. They are going back to an abortion law from the era in which leeches were used as so-called medical treatment. That's where we are today. Now, understand that the reason you might be wondering, wait a second. So the law goes back to 1864. Why is it all of a sudden coming into force? It's coming into force now because this law became unenforceable after Roe v. Wade. When Roe v. Wade set a sort of minimum framework for what it is that has to be legal and what is illegal when it comes to denying women certain care, the existence of Roe v. Wade made this 1864 law essentially irrelevant. This is not only the case in Arizona. In fact, we've talked about the very real scenario, and now it is extraordinarily real, wherein there are lots of old abortion laws which were irrelevant during the multi-decade period that Roe v. Wade was in force. When Roe v. Wade was overturned, thanks to the Supreme Court that was molded by Donald Trump's 3 Supreme Court picks, the question became, what happens now with all of these really old draconian abortion laws, at least as far as Arizona is concerned? What happens now is that those abortion laws become active law. Here is how Fox News covered this news. You reap what you sow, right, at the end of the day.
Meanwhile, John, we've got some breaking news on abortion and Arizona. The Supreme Court in that state has now ruled that it can uphold a ban on all abortions except those to save a mother's life. That this rule was a...
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
The trilateral summit will lead to the installation of foreign military bases, intensified foreign military build-up, and it will also lead to the escalation of conflict in the West Philippine Sea and in Asia Pacific.
Protests in the Philippines as President Biden hosts a first-of-its-kind trilateral summit at the White House with the leaders of the Philippines and Japan as tensions grow with China. We'll speak with acclaimed Filipino scholar and activist Walden Bello. Then Ukraine's parliament passes a contested bill to expand the military draft as the Russian invasion stretches into its third year with no end in sight.
The front line has settled into something of a stalemate and an attritional grind with catastrophic losses on both sides. And it's become somewhat of a contest of resources. And one of the resources is men, soldiers.
We'll speak with New Yorker magazine war correspondent Luke Mogelson. He's winning the prestigious George Polk Award today. It's his third in 4 years. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Israeli attacks across Gaza have killed dozens of Palestinians over the past day, including in the Nusayrat refugee camp, Gaza City, and Rafah. Palestinian officials say an Israeli airstrike killed Ridwan Ridwan, the head of the Jabalia camp's police force, who oversaw the safe travel of aid truck convoys in northern Gaza. Like much of the Gaza Strip, Jabalia has been left in utter ruins by Israel. Children are forced to play among the rubble.
We built this game because all of our toys have been destroyed, and our houses have been destroyed, and there's nothing for us to play with except this pipe.
As you can see here at the Jabalia refugee camp, mass destruction. There isn't an atmosphere of Eid or the joy that comes with it. As you can see, children are playing on the rubble and rocks, and I am entertaining them.
On Wednesday, Samantha Power, head of USAID, became the first top Biden administration official to publicly acknowledge famine is present in northern Gaza. She was questioned by House Democrat Joaquin Castro during a congressional hearing.
So there's a famine is already occurring there.
That is, yeah. Yes.
Congressmember Castro then asked Samantha Power how many children were at risk of dying in the coming weeks due to famine in Gaza.
In northern Gaza, the rate of malnutrition prior to October 7th was almost zero, and it is now one in three kids.
The Biden administration sent top military commander General Michael Correa to Israel and has restricted travel for its embassy staff in Israel as fears mount over a possible Iranian attack. The Wall Street Journal reported Thursday an attack in Israel could come by Saturday, though another unnamed source says Tehran has not made any final decisions. Iranian leadership vowed to retaliate following last week's Israeli attack on the diplomatic site in Damascus, Syria, which killed top Iranian military officials, including Mohammad Reza Zahedi, a senior commander in the Al-Quds force. In Morocco, an activist was sentenced to 5 years in prison this week for criticizing Morocco's 2020 decision to normalize relations with Israel. Abdul Rahman Zankad was arrested last month after posting on Facebook his criticism. Mexico's filed a complaint with the International Court of Justice and requested the UN expel Ecuador as tensions between the two nations rise. Last week, Ecuadorian police and military raided the Mexican embassy in Quito to arrest former leftist Ecuadorian Vice President Jorge Glass. He had been taking refuge at the embassy since December to avoid arrest on corruption charges, which he and allies say are politically motivated. This is Mexico's Foreign Secretary, Alicia Bárcena.
Mexico is accusing Ecuador of violating the diplomatic immunity of its embassy, and this is extremely serious, regardless of the cause. The fact that they have raided the embassy in a violent manner with police and military forces is a violation unjustified anywhere.
Ukraine passed a bill overhauling the military draft as a general warned lawmakers Russian forces outnumbered Ukrainian troops tenfold in the east. The new measures seek to increase troops by requiring eligible men update their draft data with authorities, increasing compensation for volunteers, and allowing some people with convictions to serve. It also does not set an upper limit for wartime military service. Lawmakers, however, were forced to remove some of the harshest draft-dodging penalties after public backlash. Family members of deployed soldiers protested the bill near the parliament in Kyiv Thursday.
Our boys and girls in the service are very tired. They have been fighting for 2 years, and no one is planning to replace them. For rotation to happen, newcomers have to know how much time they'll have to spend at the front line. Undefined mobilization terms mean fighting forever. Without strictly defined terms, no one will join the army.
The measure comes over 2 years into Russia's invasion of Ukraine and as Russian forces step up their attacks. Russia launched over 40 missiles and 40 drones at Ukrainian energy sources and critical infrastructure overnight Thursday, destroying at least one large electricity plant. We'll have more on Ukraine later in the broadcast. Polish lawmakers have begun debating reforms to Poland's near-total abortion ban, more than 3 years after mass protests against the ban rocked Poland. Poland's liberal new Prime Minister Donald Tusk pledged to bring abortion rights back, but his wide-ranging political coalition remains deeply divided on the issue. This is Dorota Oko of the Left Together Party.
Removing the provisions on imprisonment for assisting in abortion from the penal code is the first necessary step to the safety of pregnant women in our country. The place of abortion is in the medical textbook, not in the criminal code.
President Biden today announced another $7.4 billion in federal student loan relief. Around 277,000 borrowers will see their debt canceled as part of regulatory updates to existing programs. The new push will mostly benefit borrowers enrolled in SAVE, an income-driven repayment plan which relieves debt after at least 10 years of repayments. The Biden administration finalized a rule closing the gun show loophole. Vendors who sell firearms online at gun shows and through private purchases will now be required to conduct background checks on buyers. The change is expected to affect over 20,000 people who currently deal in unlicensed firearm sales. They'll also be required to register with the government. Far-right House conservatives blocked legislation that would extend warrantless surveillance after Donald Trump directed them to, quote, kill it. The move was in defiance of embattled House Speaker Mike Johnson, who's now failed three times to reauthorize Section 702 of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, or FISA. In Mississippi, six white former sheriff's deputies who belong to the self-described goon squad have each been sentenced in state court to 15 to 45 years in prison for raiding a home and torturing two black men. They'll serve the state sentences concurrently with their federal sentences, which were handed down last month and range between 10 and 40 years in prison. To see our full coverage of the story, and including interviews with the survivors, Michael Jenkins and Eddie Parker, go to democracynow.org. In Australia, conservationists warn the Great Barrier Reef could be suffering its most severe coral bleaching ever. Some 75% of the reef has bleached in the fifth such event in 8 years, which are increasing with global heating. Coral reefs are key to maintaining marine biodiversity as thousands of underwater creatures depend on them for survival, including fish, sea turtles, seabirds, jellyfish, among many more. They also protect coastal areas from major storm surges and provide livelihoods and nourishment for surrounding communities and beyond. And in Nigeria, communities are marking 10 years since the mass kidnapping of 276 girls from their school dormitory in Chibok by Boko Haram fighters. Negotiations in 2016 and 17 led to the release of about 100 of the girls, but Nigerian and international leaders have since ceased campaigning for the release of the remaining captives as mass kidnappings continue to plague Nigeria. Their families and freed survivors are demanding their safe return.
Those that remain in the bush, that are my friends, so they are my friends. So I was praying, maybe one day we still see each other. I was praying that maybe government will help us and try their best so that they will come and see their parents. The parents will see their children, okay, the way we see our own parents.
Okay. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Biden hosted a first-of-its-kind trilateral summit at the White House Thursday with Philippines President Ferdinand Marcos Jr. and Japanese Prime Minister Fumio Kishida. The summit came as the U.S. moves to expand its military presence around the South China Sea. Launching the White House meeting with the three leaders, Biden affirmed that a 1950s-era mutual defense treaty binding Washington and Manila would require the U.S. to respond to an armed attack on the Philippines in the South China Sea.
United States defense commitments to Japan and to the Philippines are ironclad. They're ironclad. As I said before, any attack on Philippine aircraft, vessels, or armed forces in the South China Sea would invoke our mutual defense treaty.
The Philippines under Marcos has deepened military ties with both the United States and Japan as maritime run-ins with China in the South China Sea have escalated. At Thursday's meeting, Marcos reaffirmed Manila's strong ties with Washington.
We meet today as friends and partners bound by a shared vision and pursuit of a peaceful, stable, and prosperous Indo-Pacific. It is a partnership born not out of convenience nor of expediency, but as a natural progression of a deepening relation and robust cooperation amongst our three countries.
Marcos has allowed the number of Philippine bases American soldiers can access to nearly double under the Enhanced Defense Cooperation Agreement. The trilateral summit sparked protests in Manila, where demonstrators marched in the streets to denounce the expanding U.S. presence in the Philippines. This is Mong Palatino, Secretary General of Bayan, an alliance of leftist groups in the Philippines, speaking at the protest.
The trilateral summit will lead to the installation of foreign military bases, intensified foreign military build-up, and it will also lead to the escalation of conflict in the West Philippine Sea and in Asia Pacific.
Thursday's trilateral summit came a day after President Biden hosted a state visit for Japanese Prime Minister Kishida, during which he unveiled a historic upgrade in military ties. For more, we're joined by Walden Bello, acclaimed Filipino scholar, activist, former vice presidential candidate in the Philippines. He just returned from Honolulu, where he was attending a conference against militarism in the Asia-Pacific region. He co-founded Focus on the Global South and is an adjunct professor of sociology at the State University of New York at Binghamton, where he's joining us from today. Walden, welcome back to Democracy Now! It's great to have you with us. You've just returned from this Hawaii anti-militarism conference, just as President Biden holds this trilateral summit with the leaders of the Philippines, as well as Japan, at the White House. Can you talk about your concerns about this meeting?
Thank you very much, Amy, for inviting me. Yes, this trilateral summit is something that really resembles something like a council of war, in which the emperor brings his local chieftains from the Pacific to come and, move in a way to raise the military containment of China. So the excuse for this has been the skirmishes between the Philippines and China in the South China Sea, or what we call the West Philippine Sea. But the larger picture really has been it's another step in the U.S.'s driven strategic containment of China. So this is, you know, in my sense, this is really a step in a kind of provocative strategy of containing China at this point in time. And it is creating tremendous alarm throughout the Pacific. And I was just in this anti-military conference in the Pacific in Honolulu, where we had activists and researchers from throughout the region coming together to share our concerns that, you know, over the last 5 years, but particularly over the last 3 years, the U.S. has been very, very aggressive in its push to so-called contain China. So we are now talking about, you know, a region where tensions are very high. And I think if this continues, things could become really, really hairy.
Now, interestingly, President Biden just spoke with President Xi of China on the phone for almost 2 hours not so long ago, but then held this trilateral summit. The headline in The New York Times, Biden aims to project united front against China at White House summit. So talk about what is happening between the United States and China, and how the Philippines, and especially activists in the Philippines, we just heard protesters, and Japan are dealing with this.
Well, you know, the United States has, you know, really moved in a strategy of containing China, as it puts it. And the Japan, South Korea, and the Philippines are on the front lines of this effort of the United States. Japan is, for all intents and purposes, still an occupied country and has been very subservient to Washington. And the Philippines, under President Marcos, has practically outsource its defense and foreign policy to the United States. Now, I served in the Philippine Congress together with Marcos, and I would just like to say at this point that he has very little notion of the national interests of the Philippines. His main concern really has been to safeguard the $10 billion worth of fortune of the Marcos family that are spread throughout the United States as well as allied states of the United States. So the alliance with the United States on the part of the Marcos family is really driven by personal economic interests. And Japan, on the other hand, has been always subservient to U.S. policy. So we are seeing the United States, in fact, fortify, move to upgrade its military deployments throughout the Pacific at this point in time. You're talking about 100 bases, at least in Japan. You have about 60 bases in South Korea. You have 9 bases in the Philippines. There's Guam. So you have this iron steel of containment that is moving, you know, against China, pushed by the United States. More than that, NATO has expanded to the South China Sea. Vessels from the UK, from Germany, from France now regularly visit the area at the behest of the United States. Australia is there. In fact, just 4 days ago, we had this announcement of U.S., Australian, Philippine, and Japanese ships getting together in deploying themselves as a so-called patrol near the territorial waters of China. So this militarization of the Pacific is very dangerous. We're you know, when you're talking about NATO ships in East Asian waters, you are really talking about a very coordinated strategy at this point that's being pushed by Washington.
In other news from the region, the U.S. has announced plans to expand a Navy base in Papua New Guinea, where China's also attempted to increase its footprint. The significance of this, Walden Bellow?
Well, yes. I mean, we will see that the United States will undertake such moves in the South Pacific. And we've got to realize also that the United States has intelligence bases in Australia, and we are talking about a situation whereby the Chinese moves have been mainly economic in nature. In fact, what we're talking about is at this point in time. There's only one Chinese overseas base, and that's in Djibouti, in the Indian Ocean. And this is mainly meant to be against piracy. But the United States has. Is expanding its base's footprint throughout in the effort to contain China, as it puts it.
And Walden, if you can talk about more about the protests on the ground in the Philippines, and I'm looking at an article from AP of December about Titu Island, the Philippines inaugurating a new Coast Guard monitoring base on an island occupied by Filipino forces in the disputed South China Sea, and the significance of this area of surveillance working with the United States.
Well, you know, the situation in the South China Sea, which we call the West Philippine Sea, the China has made a number of moves in the area, which have been quite illegal, and has threatened Philippine fishermen. And the push of China has, in fact, elicited tremendous concern among Filipinos. And, you know, this moves of declaring the South China Sea, 90% of the South China Sea as a Chinese territory, has been roundly denounced throughout the region. But the one thing that we really must put into perspective is that these moves are mainly dictated by a defensive strategy of China trying to expand its defensive perimeter outside, because the problem is that in the South China Sea, it borders the industrial infrastructure of China in the coastal areas of South and Southeastern China. And that is, you know, very vulnerable in terms of the, you know, Chinese industrial capacity. And what we are talking about is that that area is very much threatened by hundreds of U.S. bases from Japan, Okinawa, you know, the Philippines, and the Seventh Fleet is deployed constantly in the area at this point in time, and it operates up to 12 miles of China's territorial waters. The U.S. now has assigned about five carrier task forces to the Pacific out of its 11 carrier task forces. And you are talking about, you know, a situation where it's a very, very coordinated naval offensive strategy at this point in time. Now, the problem here is that, as the Vietnamese complained to me when I visited Vietnam when I was still a member of the Congress of the Philippines, is that U.S. and Chinese ships are playing chicken, in which they swerve at the last minute. But the Vietnamese raised the concern, what if you know, they miscalculate and hit each other, and a ship collision can easily escalate into a higher form of conflict because there are no rules of the game over there. So this is the kind of tension that is being pushed by the very aggressive the strategy of the United States. Now, just one more word on China. What we have pushed, or what I have pushed regarding this, is demilitarization of the South China Sea, that China and the ASEAN countries should really negotiate to demilitarize that area. And that's the route China should go through instead of unilaterally seizing territories out of defensive concerns. And I think that's still a possibility at this point in time, and we hope that China and the ASEAN countries, the Southeast Asian countries, will in fact move to demilitarize and denuclearize the South China Sea.
Finally, Waldenbello, you have a new piece in Counterpunch that's headlined Unjust Wars and a Just Peace. You write, quote, "The three major wars or conflicts that are ongoing today demonstrate the volatility of the intersection between the local and the global. In the Hamas-Israeli conflict, we see how the maintenance of the Israeli settler colonial state is intertwined with the preservation of the global hegemony of the United States. In the war in Ukraine, a bloody war of attrition between two countries provoked by Washington's push to expand NATO to a country of the former Soviet Union. In the South China Sea, we're witnessing how disputes over territory and natural resources have been elevated to a global conflict by the U.S. effort to maintain its global hegemony against China, to which it's losing the geo-economic competition, but over which it continues to enjoy absolute military superiority." Unquote. If you can finally summarize your views on this, and particularly talk about your view as co-founder of Focus on the Global South of what's happening in Gaza.
Well, you know, again, you know, this is a situation whereby the it's only U.S. military support. Tremendous support on the part of the United States, you know, in terms of providing weaponry, you know, that is enabling the Israelis and the Israeli state to commit genocide in Gaza. And the U.S. at this point in time, the only secure ally it has in the Middle East is Israel. And so we have this intersection of the global interests of the United States and, you know, the apartheid states of Israel's interest in destroying the Palestinians coming together here. And of course, you have in the Pacific, we've already talked about that, and in the Ukraine too. So the United States is very much involved in bringing local conflicts to the global stage. And the thing about this, Amy, is that in terms of the global economy, China has now outstripped the United States. It accounts for 28% of GDP growth from 2013 to 2018, whereas the United States only accounts for 14%. So, but the United States enjoys tremendous, absolute military superiority over China in all dimensions. And China is not engaged in an arms race with the United States. The latest figures from SIPRI are that the United States spends something like the order of $877 billion in military spending, and China is only about $292 billion. So it's three times, you know, what China spends. And even the Pentagon says that the orientation of China is of what it calls the strategic defensive. Not even the Pentagon at this point in time claims that it is an offensive strategy. So my only last point here is that Taiwan has often come into the news about the U.S. role in defending Taiwan. Well, let me put it this way. China would be foolish to invade Taiwan. In fact, that's never been in the cards. The China's policy has always been the sort of cross-border economic integration between Taiwan and China, which means investment integration. That's been the way that they've been pushing for unification. And And why is Taiwan being really used at this point when, in fact, the threat of invasion is not there at all? Well, as far as I can see, Taiwan is being used as the excuse to build up the Philippines as a launching pad for the containment of China. So this is sort of the dynamics that Washington is really pushing at this point in time. And as I said, if there's one major threat to peace in the Asia-Pacific region, which a number of us in Honolulu came together to really try to coordinate this effort at this point to really push back against this threat of war, it is the United States' very, very aggressive moves in the area. I would just like to say, Amy, that you have the Admiral General Minahan of the Air Mobility Command just say, you know, a few months ago in a widely quoted memo that he feels in his gut that the U.S. and China will be at war in 2025. That's the sort of rhetoric, that's the sort of mentality that Washington has been inducing among its military commanders, and that's really very dangerous.
Weldon Bello, I want to thank you so much for being with us. Acclaimed Filipino scholar, activist, co-founder of Focus on the Global South, adjunct professor of sociology now at Binghamton University in New York. We'll also link to your latest piece in Counterpunch headlined Unjust Wars and a Just Peace. When we come back, Ukraine's parliament has passed a contested bill to expand the military draft as the Russian invasion stretches into its third year. We'll get the latest from award-winning New Yorker magazine war correspondent Luke Mogelson. Stay with us.
Sa iyong mga kapaligiran, kay dumi na ng hangin, pati na ang mga ilog natin. Hindi na masama ang pag-unlad at malayo-layo na rin ang ating narating. Pastan mo ang tubig sa dagat, dati kulay asul, ngayon'y naging itim. Ang mga duming ating ikinalat sa hangin.
Observe the environment by a scene. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Ukraine's passed a contested bill overhauling the military draft as a general warned lawmakers Russian forces outnumbered Ukrainian troops tenfold in the east. The new measures seek to increase troop numbers by narrowing exemptions from military service, requiring eligible men to update their draft data with authorities, increasing compensation for volunteers, and allowing some people with convictions to serve. It also does not set an upper limit for wartime military service. The lawmakers, however, were forced to remove some of the harshest draft-dodging penalties after public backlash. The measure comes over 2 years into Russia's invasion of Ukraine, and as Russian forces step up their attacks, Russia launched over 40 missiles and 40 drones at Ukrainian energy sources and critical infrastructure overnight Thursday, destroying power plants and underground gas storage facilities in five regions across Ukraine, including the largest power generating plant in the Kyiv region. For more, we're joined by Luke Mogelson, The New Yorker magazine's award-winning war correspondent. He is winning this year's prestigious George Polk Award that's being out today, given out today in New York for magazine reporting for his article, 2 Weeks at the Front in Ukraine, for which he was embedded with Ukrainian troops. This is his third George Polk Award in 4 years. His new investigation is headlined Battling Under a Canopy of Drones. He's based in France, where he joins us from now. Luke, congratulations on these awards. Thank you so much for being with us again. Why don't we start off with your latest piece, Battling Under a Canopy of Drones. Why don't you lay out where you were in Ukraine and what's happening there today?
Thanks, Amy. I was embedded with an assault unit to the east of Kupiansk, in the northeast of Ukraine. And it's an access on the front that is under a lot of Russian pressure recently. Kupiansk is a city that's been heavily bombarded for months, and it was evacuated. The government ordered a mandatory evacuation back in August, and since then, the situation has just kind of deteriorated on the frontline trenches to the east of the city. And the unit I was with was a contingent of the 1st Separate Assault Battalion. And they are tasked by the general staff to shore up sections of the front that are in danger of collapse or to retake segments that have already been lost to the Russians. And then to hand them back over to the regular Ukrainian infantry and move on to the next area on the front that needs their that requires the same support from them. And so they've been really busy lately, especially since the failure of last year's Ukrainian counteroffensive to achieve a significant breakthrough. And basically, it's just been ongoing, relentless pressure from the Russian military all along the front since that time.
The subtitle of your piece, Battling Under a Canopy of Drones, the commander of one of Ukraine's most skilled units sent his men on a dangerous mission that required them to outmaneuver a swarm of aerial threats. So explain, bring us to the area and what these men were dealing with, what's happening generally right now in Ukraine. But tell us the story of what they were doing.
Sure. Well, they were tasked with recapturing a village called Tabaivka. And in order to do that, they had to essentially surround, flank, and attack from behind a group of Russian forces. And they had to do it without being spotted by drones, Russian drones, which is really difficult now because they're everywhere, and not just regular surveillance drones, which have been a feature of the war from its early days, but now, especially in the last 6 months, there's a new kind of drone that both the Ukrainians and the Russians have been fielding called FPVs, or first-person view drones. And they're kind of small, easily produced, very light and maneuverable drones that the pilots control with these kind of virtual reality looking like goggles, video goggles. And they can fly into trenches, they can fly into dugouts, they can go into buildings, they can chase down fleeing vehicles, they can follow squads and individual soldiers on foot. And crash into them, and they're typically deployed as kamikaze drones, so they'll have a payload of explosives attached to them, so that when they do just connect with their targets, they can explode them with like extremely lethal precision, and so that has just rendered all troop movements along the front extremely difficult and dangerous. Especially in vehicles. So for a mission like this that the 1st Assault Battalion was conducting, they actually had to wait until there was weather that impeded both the Russians and the Ukrainians from using drones. And in this case, because it was the winter, that meant snow. So they waited for a big whiteout blizzard and then went in to this area called Tabaivka on foot in the snow without any overhead surveillance or any option for a medevac or other kind of support if they got into trouble. So it was a really tough and dangerous mission, and the kind of mission that only a few units in the Ukrainian military now are capable of performing, including these guys.
I wanted to ask you about this latest news. Ukraine passing a contested bill overhauling the military draft. As a general warned lawmakers, Russian forces outnumbered Ukrainian troops tenfold in the east. The new measure seeking to increase troop numbers by narrowing exemptions for military service, requiring eligible men to update their draft data with authorities, increasing compensation for volunteers, allowing some people with convictions to serve, among other things. Can you talk about who is fighting on the front and who is back in Kyiv and the rest of Ukraine?
Yeah, I mean, to the extent that one can generalize, in my experience, which is anecdotal, but I have spent a fair amount of time on the front and with frontline units, it's predominantly working class men from rural areas or smaller villages where the draft is being more aggressively carried out than in places like Kyiv, where the Ukrainian elite and wealthier and more educated classes and citizens tend to live, or Lviv or Odessa. And certainly in the actual trenches, because you have to keep in mind, there's the military, and then there's the army, and then there's within the army the units that are actually in the trenches, which tend to be infantrymen. And those guys certainly, I would say, have a much higher proportion of lower class men and lower economic status Ukrainians.
And so you have this contested bill because it would require more people who are in more comfortable areas of Ukraine. You write about how people in the capital and other places are more and more comfortable, people on the front lines plunged into greater and greater hell.
Yeah, I mean, you can really feel the gap between the two worlds widening because the front line is just becoming more and more lethal, more and more miserable and difficult to maintain. And meanwhile, Kyiv, Lviv, Dnipro, places like this are becoming, in a lot of ways, more normal, at least for now. You know, once the air defenses start giving out, because they're already being depleted and not replaced, that could change. But these days, Kyiv is—it's easy to forget the war in Kyiv.
Talk about how the Ukrainian government is limiting coverage of the war. And you've said yourself that Ukrainian soldiers desire to share their experiences with journalists despite official restrictions.
Yeah, of course. I mean, it's always like that. And by the way, just in reference to your last question, it's not just Ukraine where you have typically poorer and less educated citizens doing most of the fighting. I mean, that's the case in any country, in any war that I've experienced, including America, certainly America during the global war on terrorism.
Right. And you've served in Afghanistan and Syria. I mean, I say serve. You've written about, the U.S. invasion in Iraq as well.
Yeah. And it's the same. It's the same with regards to the coverage. Soldiers on the front are almost always eager to have their stories told, their names recorded, what they're doing, what they're suffering, what they're living through, chronicled and witnessed. It's extremely difficult to fight a war, and it's even more difficult to do that to fight a war in obscurity, I think. And so in my experience, frontline soldiers are always happy to have journalists around. It's the brass, it's the press officers, the public affairs officers, the colonels and above, back in the rear, who tend to obfuscate and create obstacles for the press. Because they're more interested in, you know, they're less interested in an honest portrayal of the reality, and more in a kind of in political narratives. Again, not just in Ukraine, but in any war with any government.
If there isn't a negotiation, do you see any war, any end in sight, Luke Mogelson, to what you've described as this war of attrition?
Well, the end would be one side or the other winning, and the way that it's going, that would probably be Russia. So, no, I mean, I think everybody understands that at some point there needs to be a negotiation, absolutely. And the soldiers understand that and are very forthright and honest about that fact.
Well, Luke Mogelson, I want to thank you for being with us. Longtime war correspondent for The New Yorker, has reported from Ukraine, Afghanistan, Syria, Iraq. We'll link to your new piece, Battling Under a Canopy of Drones. Today, though he's in France, he's receiving the prestigious George Polk Award for his piece, 2 Weeks at the Front in Ukraine. It's his third George Polk Award in 4 years. When we come back, part two of our conversation with the prominent Israeli international law professor, Neve Gordon, on surveillance of Palestinians in Gaza and Israel's unprecedented assault. Back in 20 seconds. Lullaby by Daniel Hope and Alexei Botvinnikov. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Israel's continued aerial and ground assault on Gaza killed dozens of Palestinians today, including in the Nuseirat refugee camp in central Gaza, in Gaza City and in Rafah, where three-quarters of Gaza's population have been displaced to. The official death toll in Gaza has topped 33,600, including over 14,000 children. The actual toll expected to be far higher, with thousands of people missing and presumed dead under the rubble. More than 76,000 people have been wounded. For more on Gaza, we turn to part two of our conversation with the Israeli scholar Neve Gordon, professor of international law and human rights at Queen Mary University of London, chair of the Committee on Academic Freedom for British Society of Middle East Studies, author of a number of books, including Israel's Occupation, co-author of Human Shields, A History of People in the Line of Fire, co-editor of Torture, Human Rights, Medical Ethics, and the Case of Israel. He joined Democracy Now! Co-host Juan Nermeen Sheikh and I from London last week. I began by asking him about Israeli surveillance in Gaza.
So every state needs to impose a massive surveillance apparatus on its society, and its largest manifestation is the Center Bureau of Statistics, because in order to manage a society, you need to know a lot about it. You need to know different patterns of occupation, age, gender, race. You need to know their habits and so forth. And so when Israel enters the Gaza Strip and the West Bank, the first thing, or one of the first things it does, is it begins to monitor and survey the population it is managing, which also tells us a lot about its intentions and the fact that it had no intention of withdrawing from Gaza and the West Bank after the war in 1967, because you don't put in place such a massive surveillance apparatus where you look at every letter sent, you go in and see what how many frigidaires people have, how many stoves they have, what kind of crops they're growing in their agricultural fields, everything like that. You don't put that in place if you're planning to leave, but you put it in place if you plan to manage the population. And Israel managed the Palestinian population until Oslo, where basically the Oslo Accords can be understood as the creation of a sub-Palestinian authority, that it would take over the management of the daily life of the Palestinians, and the PA then creates its own Central Bureau of Statistics. And Israel changes then the kinds of surveillance that it carries out vis-a-vis the Palestinian population, because it is no longer responsible for the life of the Palestinians, the PA is, but now it is responsible for the security of Israel in relation to the Palestinian body. So it surveys the Palestinian body only insofar as it helps Israel ensure its so-called security. And so we see a change in the surveillance apparatus, and we see what I call in my first book a move from a politics of life, a politics where Israel is planting 200,000 or so trees in the Gaza Strip, versus a politics of death where Israel is uprooting 200 or so thousand trees in the Gaza Strip. Now, over time, technologies develop, the military develops new technologies of surveillance, and one friend who works in the Israeli intelligence basically told me, we can see almost everything in the Gaza Strip, whether it's through our Zeppelins, whether it's through our drones, whether it's through satellites and different devices. And Israel monitors every little step in the Gaza Strip. Every SIM card in the Gaza Strip is monitored. A lot of times when they say they're targeting a person, they're targeting the SIM card. So what we have is a whole massive apparatus of surveillance that has existed for years for military use. But what is new, or relatively new, I think it was first put to use in 2021, is the use of AI system. It's the kind of feeding of the data that Israel collects through its surveillance system to a machine that uses algorithms then basically to create different kinds of networks and to identify Hamas operative or different Palestinian fighters or other issues, because the bottleneck in the different cycles of violence that Israel has had, and as I mentioned, it had five since 2008, was always the targets, the kill targets, because it would take an intelligence officer sometimes days or weeks to kind of figure out a target. And here you can put the data into the machine, and the machine, as the article in 972 tells us, the machine within a limited amount of time can produce 37,000 human targets. Now, the machine itself, the Israelis itself are telling us that there's a 10% error rate even in that machine, even according to Israel. Yet that Israel ignored that 10% error rate, and then it just started using this machine algorithms to bomb people in Gaza, as you said.
Professor Niamh Gordon, this is the first time that we're speaking to you since the October 7th attack. So I want to ask you, you've just quoted an Israeli intelligence official who told you that given the extensive surveillance system that they have in place in Gaza, they can see almost everything that happens there. So in light of that, could you tell us what your initial response was to the Hamas attack in Israel, and then what's unfolded since? Of course, you point out in the piece that the speed and scale scale of the devastation of Gaza is without parallel this century. So if you could talk about that.
So the October 7th attack, as an Israeli Jew, was both horrific and devastating. A former graduate student of mine was killed on that day. A music teacher from my children's school was killed on that day. His wife was killed on that day. And a friend that we thought was kidnapped was also turned out to have been killed on that day. And it was a very, very painful moment for me. And it was a very, very painful moment, I think, for most Israelis. And the audience needs to understand that Israel's a small country, and the degree of separation between either a person that was killed or a person that was kidnapped in Israel, the maximum degree of separation is probably 1 degree. So everyone knew someone or knew someone that knew someone, and there was this kind of immense pain. And alongside that pain, there was also a major fear, because everything seemed to have collapsed. The major IDF intelligence apparatus was not working. The defense system was not working. The fence was breached without any problems. And the whole apparatus of the state seemed not to be functioning. So most Israelis were in great pain, were in great fear. But also immediately came this notion of revenge, kind of a sense we have to hit back, we have to hit back hard, and so forth. And my fear is that most Israelis are still trapped, still stuck in that October 7th moment and unwilling to lift their eyes to see basically the genocide unfolding in the Gaza Strip. And that's what we've been seeing in the past 6 months, is this horrific devastation, massive killings of civilians. We have, Hamas killed 30 Israeli children on October 7th, and that is horrific. Israel has killed close to 15,000 children, not counting those that are under the rubble, since October 7th. We need to understand that figure. 15,000 children have been killed. We have women, thousands of women have been killed, and thousands of innocent men have been killed. Israel categorizes all the men as terrorists, but thousands of these men were not fighters. They were just men that were in the homes with their wives, with their children, and their homes were bombed. And so we see the massive displacement of 1.7 million people. We see 70% of the Gaza Strip now in basically rubbles. We see systematic attacks on the healthcare, that the healthcare is now, which is the institution responsible for saving lives, it's now completely shattered. So it's all been very devastating for me as an Israeli Jew to watch this kind of horrific violence unfolding in the Gaza Strip, with friends and friends of friends, again, dying. It's not as if I don't have friends in the Gaza Strip. We see the academia and education system. I mean, all the universities have been bombed in the Gaza Strip. We have almost half the schools are either damaged or destroyed. One third of these schools are irreparable. So one third of the children, even after the war, will not have schools to return to. So it's just complete devastation, and it's beyond words at this point.
Israeli scholar Niamh Gordon, professor of international law and human rights at Queen Mary University of London, chair of the Committee on Academic Freedom for British Society of Middle East Studies and chair of the Committee on Academic Freedom for British Society. He's the author of several books, including Israel's Occupation, and co-author of Human Shields, A History of People in the Line of Fire, co-editor of Torture, Human Rights, Medical Ethics, and the Case of Israel. To see our full interview with Neve Gordon, you can go to democracynow.org. A happy birthday to Anna Özbek and Maria Inez Taracena. Democracy Now! Is currently accepting applications for our digital fellowship. You can learn more and apply at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Firk, Dina Guzder, Sharif Abdelkadous, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Taracena, Tammy Warnoff, Trina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamaria Studio. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
RCT Pittsburgh, the last bastion of pulchritude.
Please don't silence time, it's life. Open your eyes.
Busque entrar.